Hey, it's Brent Smith, and welcome to BSL Insider Radio. Today, my very special guest is Philip Shepherd from philipshepherd.com. Philip is a faculty member of the Institute for Sacred Activism and is the author of New Self, New World. His book has been hailed as a masterpiece by Andrew Harvey and has earned international praise for its revelation of our culture's deep disconnections and how they are all rooted in our relationship to the body. Philip has taught workshops on creativity and presence over 30 years and speaks internationally on the importance of deepening into the wholeness of the self's truth. He also lives with his wife and two daughters in a home he designed and built in a little car-free community on an island south of Toronto. So, Philip, I'm going to let you talk about the rest, but thanks so much for being here. We're excited to talk to you.
I'm excited to talk with you guys, too. Absolutely.
And today, of course, I have Dylan Prema with me, and I also have Jason Troy. How are you guys doing?
Fantastic. I think Philip is going to bring some clarity to the chaos world through this conversation with us as well. So happy to have you.
Yeah, it's going to be great. We're looking forward to having you, Philip. I was looking through your very interesting background that people are going to find fascinating, and we will be talking on a myriad of topics here, and there is so much to cover. Why don't we just get started? Why don't you tell everyone, we like to tell people about people's backgrounds, they can ground them in where you're coming from and kind of your just philosophy. So why don't you just take people kind of back on your journey and how you kind of came to where you are right now?
Yeah, where I'm at now really springs from where I was at as a enraged teenager. I could literally feel the suppositions and assumptions of my culture boxing in my thinking in such a way that it was being funneled down these well-worn grooves, and I couldn't stand it and rebelled against it, but still was drawn like the way an undertow pulls you down. So I realized in order to get free of that, I had to get free of my culture. So I went to England and bought a bicycle and cycled. My plan was to cycle as close as I could to Japan, and I got to through Europe and the Middle East and India, and then couldn't go any further because of China. So then I flew to Hong Kong and to Osaka and cycled through Japan. And on the way, on a bicycle, you're so open and vulnerable and exposed to the world around you. And I passed through so many different ways of understanding what it means to be human. And every one of them was luminous and every one of them was limited. And the only time I suffered culture shock was when I came home after 2 years. And it was like looking through a prism, because what was so deeply familiar to me was at the same time rendered bizarre and arbitrary. So that trip enabled me to formulate questions about my own culture that I wouldn't otherwise have been able to articulate. And that formulation of questions, that journey was facilitated by my love of theater. I actually went to Japan to study classical Japanese theater because it's this exquisitely beautiful art form. And at the same time, when I first saw it in Canada, I didn't understand what they were doing. I didn't understand how they had managed to wrought such magic on the stage. And so my studies in Japan brought me in touch with the Japanese concept of hara. Hara is a Japanese word that means belly, but to the Japanese, it's not just belly. It's this hara is the place you go to connect with your deepest truths and your profoundest understandings, and it's from that place that these Japanese actors were moving and speaking on stage, which is how this art form generated such power. So I began, training and working as an actor in North America largely, and got in touch with my body and the body's energy and learned what it is to drop out of the head and ground yourself in that place. And eventually I started teaching workshops on that because it's just a matter of learning how to navigate the corridors of the body in such a way that you can come to rest in your own center and join the present moment. And it turns out that actually though any skill an actor acquires, any exercise he learns is really just another way of learning to be present. So all those skills I learned as an actor transferred directly into just walking down the street on an ordinary afternoon. So that's kind
fascinating.
Of
that is fascinating.
Yeah, I love that, you know, going away and then the biggest culture shock you had was coming back.
It was so strange.
I like that. I like that kind of idea.
Yeah, and so many choices we take for granted are just arbitrary. So even like when I was in India, I was with this theater company that does Kathakali, which is this ancient form of dance drama. And performances begin with the setting of the sun, and it goes on all night long and ends with sunrise. And before this performance, you know, we're sitting around. They invited me to share dinner. Well, dinner, you're sitting cross-legged on the ground, and dinner's on a palm leaf, and you're kind of reaching, and everyone's jostling, and this intercourse of fun and food and ideas, and it's all kind of swirling around, and it's so different from our North American paradigm, where you sit in your seat with your placemat that defines your space, and God forbid you should need the salt on the other side of your partner's space, because you can't reach through their space to get to the salt. You have to say, please, would you pass me the salt? You know, this, we forget that the word privacy shares the same Latin root as the word privation. You gain something, you lose something, and we're not always aware of what that trade-off is.
Wow.
That's fantastic.
That's great.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you. The first thing that I was reading that you were talking about was what we call, you start to talk about living, you know, people are living in a fantasy land, being sucked into kind of the cultural norms. We call it the matrix here, being brought into attachments, limitations, consumerism from advertisers that get people following down a very predictable path where they're easily controlled
social
and wanting brain, comparison.
Brain, all that stuff.
Yes, all those things. And I know that you know, mentioned that stuff in here in a little bit different terminology, but literally the same thing. And I know you talked about it when you were younger and how you got out of it, but I wonder if you could talk about it a little bit and how you kind of found a way out of it, because I think that's a conversation we consistently have with people.
Yeah, it's funny, Tim, because the way out of it, in a way, is by joining the world. But I say that in a very specific way because we do live in our heads. We're taught to live in our heads. We're told that, you know, that we should have a good head on our shoulders, and two heads are better than one, and you want to be in head office at headquarters. It's all about the head. And the implicit message is your head should be in control. Your head should be in charge. But the problem is that when we move into our heads, we're disconnecting from all the bodily sensation and sensuality that is moving hand in hand with the present moment. And so we live by an idea of the present rather than in kinship with it. And part of my journey was indeed, how do you drop out of your head down through the body to come to rest on the pelvic floor, really is how I can most specifically talk about it. Now, when you're at rest in your body as a whole, you sort of discover your being. And we think that our being is what's trapped inside our skins. But the reality is your being is contingent on absolutely everything around you and everything beyond that you can't even see or hear. So your being is what you discover when you're fully present. And as soon as you come into accord with that different energy, you're coming into a sort of non-personal space where you're not, you know, when you're living in your head, you take everything personally, and everything's about agenda and control and how do you look and how are you being judged and how are you judging yourself, and that's just such a deadly siphon that sucks you into abstraction and disconnection and self-consciousness. Now, the antidote to self-consciousness is in effect world consciousness. So when you drop down and come to rest in the pelvic bowl in that way, and it's almost like a shift that what our culture places in the foreground of our attention is doing, and being is in the background, if it's noticed at all. They did this really interesting experiment where they showed paintings to a large number of people in Asian cultures, and the same paintings to a large number of people in Western cultures. And for a given time, you could look at the painting, and then you were asked questions about what you saw. And the people from Western cultures would always talk about the figures in the foreground and what they were doing, and the people from the Oriental cultures tended to comment on the background, what was happening in the background. And it's so interesting, just as an experiment, to drop down into your body and allow background and foreground to shift. So it's sort of your sense of the enclosed, disconnected self is softened and melts, and what comes to the foreground are the swimming currents of the life around you. And suddenly you're in this sort of non-personal space of being and experience. And what's funny to me is that by allowing yourself to come into that space, intimacy becomes more deeply experienced rather than less deeply experienced. And because you're connecting with your being, you're not acting out of this disconnected emptiness at your core that needs to be flattered and assured and needs to buy things and needs to, you know, this appetite, the addictions that drive our culture spring from a disconnection from our own being. What we're longing for is an experience of being, and that's the very thing we've denied ourselves by living in the head.
And that's the very thing that advertisers count on so that we will think that buying their product is the cure for that.
That's the way advertising is aimed. So subtly, if you buy our product, you will be free. If you buy our product, you will be attractive. All these insecurities, when you're disconnected from your being, the trigger points are greed and fear. And if you can play on your greed and your fear, you'll stimulate a lot of sales.
Yeah, and by the way, everyone listening, I'm not down on advertisers. I mean, I like to have a vibrant economy. But if you're wondering why this is happening, a lot of it is that. And there definitely, is a light at the end of that tunnel. But that's why we have these discussions, because advertisers will always follow the money, and the money will always be dictated by your behavior as a person and as a consumer and as a being. Connect this when we're talking.
Yeah, there's an ethos to advertising, which is that you offer something of value. And, whether it's a funny ad that a lot of attention's gone into or something, but you offer something of value. And that's sort of been supplanted by this drive to manipulate. And that drive goes way back. There's a fabulous documentary online done by the BBC called The Century of the Self. And it shows how our self absorbed culture was sort of corralled and shepherded by corporations and politicians. And one of the most striking examples to me was this guy Bernays, who was actually Sigmund Freud's nephew. Early on in the suffragette movement, tobacco companies came to him and said, we've got this huge problem, you know, because we're missing half our market. Women aren't smoking. And he said, let me think about that. So what he did, there was this suffragette event happening. And there was press there and a lot of attention. And he got five of the suffragettes at a certain point to light up a cigarette and announced that this was their torch of liberty. And it's such a cynical ploy. And it worked.
Yeah.
Don't take my torch of liberty from me.
Wow.
I mean, a cigarette is a sign of slavery. And here, you hold a cigarette, you're saying, I'm addicted, I'm a slave to this thing. And here it is being presented as a torch of liberty.
Yeah, well, I think it's important for people to understand that. We talk about it a lot because, and I try not to be negative about it, because I'm not being negative about it. But everyone kept asking us, why is this happening? Why is it? They couldn't get past the why. So I said, well, okay, I'm going to bring up the most obvious thing you haven't thought about, and that's that 24/7 you get messages that tell you that you're powerless and that you'd be powerful if you buy this product. And so that's the opportunity. And like I said earlier, it's not. We don't want people to stop buying stuff. We just, buy them for different reasons. Advertisers will always follow the money, and the economy will be fine, but it has to start somewhere. It has to start with awareness, because they're just doing what comes naturally to them, which is immediate gratification, sell product, make profit. Sell product, make
profit.
That's
it. Exactly.
And that's the bottom line, and that's what their responsibility actually is. So that's fine. We just need to, they'll follow the money. So, vote with your money and your behavior.
And bring awareness to it, absolutely.
Yeah, bring awareness to it. So just wanted to touch on that. But I think that's fascinating because we do talk about that a lot. And I think it's fascinating what you said about it. It's from a little bit different terminology and a little bit different perspective, but I love it. And I hope all of you out there are listening to this and this very creative way of talking about it.
Philip, you were just, what I heard just a second ago also is, it sounded like you were talking about that existential emptiness that some people refer to. And it sounds like you're saying that the best way to deal with that is through connecting with your beingness. Am I hearing that correctly?
Yeah. You know, our whole culture is based on values that reflect our relationship to the body. So, it's a bizarre thing when you realize that our culture says up is good and down is bad. You're looking up today, you're looking a little down. Things are looking up. He's in the pit of despair. He's on cloud nine. You think, where's heaven? It's up. Where's hell? Well, that's the down place, right? And the South Pole is up every bit as much as it is down. It's arbitrary, except that the people who mapped out the world lived in the Northern Hemisphere, so of course they had to put themselves on top. But these cultures, these values are a reflection of our relationship to the body. We do not allow ourselves to drop down into the body's intelligence because it means a softening or a loosening of control in order to be able to do that. And a coming to rest, you need in a way to have the trust and the faith to do that, to drop. We'll allow ourselves to listen to the body, but when you think about that paradigm, listening to the body, The metaphor is telling you, well, your body is in the room next door, and it's prudent once in a while to put your ear to the wall separating you from it so that you can hear what's going on the other side. That's a sort of deeply corrupt idea of embodiment, because it's actually telling you you are separate from the body, and your relationship to it should be one of a listener. But once you actually allow your awareness to drop into the body, then you acquire the ability to listen to the world through the body.
Mm.
And once
yeah,
you
and
listen, once you listen to the world,
yeah,
yeah, and then once you connect with the world in that way, you respond to the world, and out of that responsiveness, true responsibility is born.
Ah, that's what I was going to touch on next. As I'm
yes.
listening to you, I was going to say it's a lot like avoiding responsibility. And when you
yes.
avoid responsibility, as a lot of people do, and I was definitely one of those people, I thought that I was in control by avoiding taking responsibility. But what I found out is that when I let go of that and took responsibility, I was actually finally truly in control of my life. So it's a fake control. I thought I had control, but it was a fake control. And so I'm just connecting that to what you just said. When you will give that up and allow yourself to drop down, right, what you give up what you think is control, which is just fake, and
yeah.
you drop down into your body, then you will be in control for the first time in your life.
Yeah, and it's
and
a diff-
it,
it's
yeah.
The way I would talk about the difference in what that second control is it's like the control that a surfer has riding a wave. And you don't imagine that you're controlling the wave, but you can feel the wave with such sensitivity that you can control your path up and over and around and through and under.
Yeah.
You're dancing with that wave of being with a sensitivity that's impossible as long as you hold on to that old concept of control.
Yeah, and
it's a great
allowing.
Way of explaining it.
Yeah, and you're allowing too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that cultural thing we have of neglect. We turn away from things we don't like. We don't think about things. We try not to think about things that we think we shouldn't think about. We're always trying to manage our own thoughts. But every instance of neglect in our lives shows up as a shadow in the body. Because you're deadening yourself to what you feel shouldn't be felt. And as long as the body is riddled with shadows, of course you can't come to rest in it. Of course you can't feel it as a whole. Of course you'll have disconnected from your being, and your life will be driven by a sort of craving that you can't really question or get any kind of clarity on.
You know, Philip, hypothetically speaking, what do you envision would happen if everyone just to go in their body and connect with themselves more and be in touch with their beingness? What would you envision happening?
Here's the way I would imagine the most radical change.
Okay.
When you're living in your head in that place of control, and sort of control is how you understand the means of survival to be, then when you look at the world, you see danger.
Mm.
When you look at the world and see danger, you react, right? And,
yeah.
and you get anxious, and that anxiety never really completely goes away. Now, when you go to that other place where your body is allowed to be felt as a whole in harmony, then suddenly that feeling of harmony is something that you value. And harmony and control are opposites, right? It's like harmony is this give and take in which every part of a whole answers to every other part, and control is a way of imposing order. In which every part is fixed in a place that is deemed appropriate to it. So when you're in that place of harmony, and that's what your concern is, you look out at the world and you see dance. And you join the dance. And suddenly things soften, and we're not driven by fear. We're moved by open hearts, and we don't fear each other. We see ourselves in each other. There's that fabulous Mayan greeting that, you know, where you meet someone and you say hello. Well, in the Mayan culture, they meet someone and they say in Lakesh. In Lakesh translates as I am another you. Can you imagine saying that to everyone you meet? I am another you. How that would change. And then our drive to impose control on the world would yield to a desire to come into harmony with it. And we're stuck on this notion that knowledge is going to save us. I mean, at the core of our culture, we're driven by this belief that if we can get enough knowledge, that will save us. And if there were any truth at all to that crazy idea, we'd be in so much better shape now than we were 200 years ago. And in fact, we're cacked. 200 years ago, there were still rivers you could drink from, and you could breathe the air, and it was clean. And knowledge isn't going to save us. And what we've done, and you know, it's a product of living in our heads, because that's what the head values, is its ability to perceive, gain perspective. Yeah, but what we've done. See, there's this huge imbalance. I'm writing a book at the moment that looks at this, where we've come to perceive self-knowledge as a kind of knowledge. And self-knowledge and knowledge are opposites. So we imagine self-knowledge to be this like grocery list of, well, I have blue eyes and yellow is my favorite color and these are my values and this is what I believe in, and like this list of things. But that's knowledge. That's not self-knowledge. Self-knowledge is what is brought to you by the world itself, that when you drop into your own being, when you drop into that realm you discover when you're fully present, the world will speak to you and will reveal who you are in this moment through it. It's like knowledge is a self-centered understanding of the world. Knowledge is something you possess and can use as leverage to move the world to your advantage. Self-knowledge is a world-centered understanding of the self.
It's awareness.
A completely different thing. Yeah, and it's there's nothing in self-knowledge that is pinned down. It's part of the flow of the present. The present is always an unknown. You've never been in this moment before. You never will again. Each breath is an entree into the next unknown moment. And if you're carrying sort of knowledge as self-knowledge, if you're carrying this grocery list into the present, then you're disabling yourself from truly responding to it freely, and then you never really find out who you are.
Yeah, you know, Philip, we talk about very often that you should, instead of reading 100 books or 1,000 books or whatever, and intellectualizing everything, it's more important to go out and meet people, live, give, inspire people, and that could be so much more of education than any books can give you. You know,
yeah, do you know the Franz Kafka saying that a great book should be an ice pick to break up the frozen realms within us? I love books, but there's books tend to become successful by offering easy solutions. And easy solutions always stand apart from an experience of the present. And until you can nurture yourself into the gentleness of being that will welcome the present moment, you'll be governing yourself and managing yourself according to ideas that you've gathered that instruct you about what is right and what is good and what will work and what won't work, and it's not, you know, what I love about books, and being an author, it's hard to dismiss the value of books altogether. What I love about books,
too, so not books or anything, but just.
What I love about books is that certain kinds of understanding can give you choice. It's like if you don't understand that you're stuck in your head because of a cultural paradigm, and that every cell of the body is suffused with intelligence, and that you have the option of dropping down into that intelligence and feeling its pulse. If you're not even aware of that as a choice, then it's really hard to get unstuck from where you are. So sometimes understanding can birth in us a new awareness of possibility and choice. And I think that's books that do that are brilliant. And what they do, of course, is reconnect you with the world and move you into it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, Philip, I read something really beautiful on your site that I think, and just honest, and I think our listeners would appreciate it as well. And it's, I want to read it really fast. It's called the Embodiment Manifesto.
Mm.
The blind spot we harbor, the revolution to come. I believe that humanity can survive the crises that are mounting around us, but that our ability to make it will depend on us forging a new kind of clarity. Specifically, we need to share a story we tell ourselves about to be human. It's a story almost too familiar to question, yet it provokes fantasies of limitless growth and power and puts us on a collision course with the realities of our world. I believe this story is the single greatest danger to our survival. I also believe that the most dangerous effect of this story is the way it estranges us from our own bodies and makes that feel normal. I mean, there's so much there. And,
yeah.
We talk about the story often. I know, Jason, I'm sure you have something to say on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just powerful. I mean, I think story is just such a big... We always talk about that as like the cornerstone, and we always work with all, you know, everyone in our community about really fundamentally understanding their story and really being able to create a new story, and focusing on that, because your mind is really controlling you at some point, and most people don't even think about it or realize it at some point of all that goes on, and your thoughts create actions, which then obviously creates the life that you're living moment to moment, and you're powerful, and you can obviously change all that and make it a whole different life and transform all in a moment. And for a lot of people, that's a hard concept to grasp, but it's possible. And when people consider that possibility, then they can actually start to be alive and realize that they're, you know, one with the universe and world around them, and they can be in harmony the moment that they decide to be in harmony. And it's not a process. They don't have to spend years getting in it. They can actually make that decision right now. But people, it's often a tough leap for people to make that, because then they have to let go of all their attachments and limitations. And then, again, I think for a lot of people, the challenge goes back to being either right or being happy. And being present in their life. That's a difficult thing to do.
And I also want to throw in there that, honestly, the way that I started teaching story back in the day, when I believed that it's the most important thing is giving the customer what they want, even if you know it's not what they need and won't help them, because what level they're by is what you should give them, which I don't operate by anymore. And I didn't really overdo it anyway back then. But, you know, when we talk about story, changing someone's story was always to get transformation, to get something, to get a better life, to get more money, to get better companion, to get out of something and into something else. And where that led people was to a certain place where they could go no further, because it was still based on getting. And so now what we've woven in, and I just thought this was relevant, so I threw it out there, but what we've woven in now is a higher purpose. So that's, we've changed the way we talk about story into okay, we understand what your life story is now, and that's the reality for you. That's the identity you've created. Let's talk about, you know, let's talk about solving those, but the other piece, the huge piece now, is changing your purpose. And in your story, you should always have things about helping, giving, and inspiring, and being, and, you know, our transformation equation, which is about being grateful, changing your story, giving up attachment, taking responsibility, changing your purpose from getting to one of giving, helping, and inspiring, and then create for it and be it, and then transformation. But even beyond that, that transformation isn't always a personal transformation. It's also a world transformation. It's a worldview. And so, you know, when we talk about changing your story and solving what you think are your personal issues by helping someone else solve theirs, or solving, you know, your issues by solving the world's issues, if you want to go really big on that. And so that, now it has always have something about giving in it. And so story, to bring it back around, is, in the way that you spoke about it, is very powerful in that manifesto, because I truly think that that is it's the beginning of everything. It's really where people, you know, where people are coming from. They're coming from their story, and everyone's got one.
Yeah. There's another side to it as well that I'm working on in my book, which has to do with becoming an adult, and we've lost any meaningful rite of initiation in our culture in terms of adulthood.
I
think adulthood is like, oh, you go to university, you graduate, you get a job, you marry, whatever.
But you look at
those ancient rites. And what they often involve, whether it's a vision quest or a walkabout, is a young man who is in the embrace of his society's story about what it means to be human and what the world is about. And in the initiation, he steps out of the boundary of that story and encounters reality in all his nakedness, and discovers in that encounter that no story is capable of containing the present. No story is capable of framing what it means to be human. And so the story, in a way, falls apart or leaks out, and the room is made for something else. And that direct encounter with reality asks something of you. It always asks something of you. The world is always inviting you to action. And it's inviting you to action not to promote the self, but just to join in, to help out, to give it your all and make a difference. Sometimes that ask is as simple as allow yourself to breathe, right? Because until you let your breath fully into your body and allow it to connect with the energy of your being in that way, you can't ignite the energy of your being. But that idea of leaving behind the story that you have been suckled on since you were an infant, and encountering reality directly, is something, if we can but recognize the need for that, everything would change. Everything would change. Politicians, I hear them go on endlessly, and what they're doing is they're defending the story they've grown up with against all comers. They're denying information that might contradict that story, and reshaping other information to affirm it. And it's all about propping up a derelict story. It's incredible. But we do that in our personal lives as well.
Yeah, what do we do to bring back that sort of initiation into adulthood, where we sort of renounce and let go of our premature attachments and kind of rebirth into this this new sense of beingness, this new mature beingness, evolved beingness. What can we do to bring back that sort of initiation process, or create some sort of process around that?
There's so many ways of going about it. One way of stepping out of the story is to drop into your body, because our culture says you should live in your head. The head should be in charge. The head will save you. And so just by dropping into the body's intelligence and submitting to it, letting go of all preconceptions and submitting to that humming intelligence is stepping out of the story. And when I teach workshops, I've got so many exercises that come at that from a slightly different perspective, and you can see people in the course of a weekend kind of softening and seeing things differently and hearing things differently, and it's a wonderful thing for me to witness as a facilitator. But if you can head off into the bush, get a canoe, go hiking, whatever it is, and just be aware that you're encountering something so much bigger than you are, and soften yourself into a willingness to learn from it. There's a great poet. There's a Japanese poet, Basho, who said, "To learn from the pine, go to the pine. To learn from the bamboo, go to the bamboo." Mm. No book will tell you what that direct experience can offer.
Mm. Nice.
Is that something we have to seek out, the direct experience?
I think so. I mean, I think the aspects of our culture that try to deaden us because, you know, we're so much easier to manipulate in a slightly deadened state. I think we either allow that deadening to seep into our bodies, or we actively seek to transgress its boundaries. I did that as a teenager, sort of half aware of what I was doing. I just knew I had to. I knew I had to get out of my culture, and I knew that it had to happen on a bicycle, you know, through lands I'd only heard of.
That's fantastic. We can talk about your new book. I mean, and talk about kind of some stuff and things inside of there, because I think that's kind of fascinating. I don't know if you have a working title on it, if only you knew what your body knows, and just we could talk about some of the concepts and things that you are going to explore in that book.
Yeah, the title still tickles me, "If Only You Knew What Your Body Knows," because there's a way of knowing that our culture barely recognizes. We call it a gut instinct sometimes, and don't really trust it. And what we've come to put all our faith in is what I call digital knowing. It's like facts, knowledge, little bits and pieces of information about the world that we're hoping will add up to a whole, but it will never happen because these are just fragments of perspective. There's another kind of knowing that I call analog knowing. And it's, you know, I think of a story about Polynesian navigators who, you know, navigate the Pacific Ocean. They can leave their island home and find another island that's 500 miles away across the Pacific Ocean. And that borders on the impossible. But it turns out that navigators are chosen as infants, and they're put in these tidal pools for hours at a time, just buoyed by the sea, and they acquire a sensitivity that is fostered and nurtured over time, so that when they're young men, they can sit in a dugout canoe on the ocean and feel up to 5 distinct swells moving beneath the hull, which is unimaginable to me, but they do it. And those swells are refraction patterns from islands that may be beyond the horizon. And according to those refraction patterns, they can navigate their way. So they are attuned through the body to the subtlety of the world. And in the same way that they can navigate the currents of the ocean through those subtle soundings of waves and currents, we live in this ocean of energy that we all but turn a blind eye to while we're living in our heads. And we think the aim of life is to make ourselves happy. And we're encouraged to think that. But gosh, the world wants something so much bigger from us than that. And you know, the what the world calls us towards, and it's like the call of the hero. It's the mythic call. Come and risk and play and find something out. And it's not guided by reason. Our attachment to reason as the ultimate arbiter of reality is such a paper thin sham. You can't reason your way into the present. You can't reason your way to love. You can't reason your way into anything that really matters in this life. So you look at what most matters, and it's beyond the reach of reason. It's not even in the same realm as reason. And you think, well, what are we up to, trying to outthink life and trying to win, you know, by developing the right strategy of life? And what you guys are saying about the importance of opening your heart to others and helping them. Somewhere in my book I say it doesn't matter whether or not you've been loved in your life. What matters is that you're capable of love. That's what nourishes you. Because you can't control your past. You can't go back and make, you know, change the past to a story that your mother did love you. And that doesn't matter. What matters is what you're with now and what the world is calling from you, and to be able to offer love to the world will change everything in your life. And we, you know, we think of love as an emotion, and like anger or jealousy or whatever. Love isn't an emotion. Love is a state of heightened sensitivity. In the state of love, we come most fully into our own intelligence, in fact, because I think of George Washington Carver, the botanist who healed plants and healed people with plants. And somebody said to him, "Why? How is it that you know so much about plants?" And he said, "Well, if you love something enough, it will speak to you." He loved the plants with this sensitivity that he understood. They spoke to him. All the world spoke to him, and all the world will speak to us. So that idea that if only you knew what your body knows ultimately goes down to the message that the world fucking loves you. And how do you open to that love? And how do you dance with that love?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
Embodying it. Embodying being. Yeah.
Yeah.
We always talk about being beyond logic and beyond common sense.
Yes.
Note the word common. So it's beyond reasonableness, beyond common logic, beyond common sense. It's uncommon sense, uncommon logic, uncommon reason, reasonable.
Yeah, and it's so ordinary in its way. It's so ordinary. I mean, you look at, have you guys ever seen starlings where you get like 5,000 birds in this huge cloud that compresses and expands and dances across the sky? Phenomenal sight. They're acting on what their body knows, and they are in such sensitive harmony, and it's the most ordinary thing in the world, but as a culture, we've turned our backs on the ordinary to the extent that, if we're buying a pen, we need the best pen, or we need the best watch, as if an $80,000 watch could tell time better than an $80 watch, and it can't. But what is ordinary connects us to everything else, and because we live in our heads, we want to rise above the ordinary and live in the penthouse and sort of gaze down at everything from a distance and not have to deal with the ordinary. But the ordinary is the nourishment for the very roots of your being. The wood floor I'm walking on came from trees that breathed oxygen into the air that nourished my grandparents. It's all this dance, and to disconnect from the body is ultimately to disconnect from the entire dance.
Wow. You hear a lot about mind power and the intelligence of your mind, but do you feel that the intelligence of the body is what trumps the power of the mind?
No, greater. I sort of, I see the mind, I see consciousness. It's like this bar magnet through the body. Now, we don't have a bar magnet. We have a little fragment of a magnet up in our heads. But really, our intelligence, our consciousness, is this bar magnet that sustains a field around us, and it runs right like from the pelvic floor up to the head, and it's a connected exchange with a pole that up at the top is capable of reason and abstraction and perspective, and a pole at the bottom that is capable of sensitivity and knowing through the waves of the ocean which way the island lies, and there's this exchange and dance between these poles, and if we live that exchange, everything is mind. Everything is mind. Your toes are mindful. The tree outside the window is mindful. The world is suffused with mind. Problem is, we've contracted our idea of mind. We've contracted it to our idea of brain. And our lives are impoverished as a result.
Yeah, instead of just really being attuned to what is and working with it, we're caught up in labeling everything and attaching superficial meanings to everything. So, yeah, we can definitely see that.
Yep. You guys have anything else? We've covered so much today. I think when people will have to listen to this podcast several times.
How about times?
Maybe several hundred times. It's a lot to think about, a lot to chew on.
A lot to feel.
A lot to feel. Yes. Thank you for that. A lot to feel. So, I think this is a discussion that will continue. I'm sure we will collaborate additionally. But this is a great start. So Philip, I want to thank you for being here with us today and sharing all that you've shared. It was tremendous.
And just such a pleasure for me, guys. Thank you so much.
And I know that a lot of people out there had some tremendous insights. And of course, as you have them, please take action on them immediately. Philip, where do you want people to go to find out more about what you're doing, what you're up to?
Oh, there's lots on my website, which is philipshepherd.com. The problem is the spelling. Philip is with one L, P-H-I-L-I-P, and Shepherd is like the guy who looks after sheep, S-H-E-P-H-E-R-D. So philipshepherd.com has the embodiment manifesto that you read from. It has an interview I did with the Sun magazine that is really maybe the best the best brief summary of my work and what I'm up to, and it has a schedule. I've got workshops coming up in Florida and England and Montreal, and it's all on the website and lots of other stuff. So philipshepard.com, I'd love you to have a look.
Yeah, and the book New Self, New World. And we've also got your other book on the way, and New Self, New World is available on Amazon, so everybody go in there and pick it up. And go to Philip's website, philipshepard.com. And that's great. I want to thank also Dylan for being here, and Jason, thanks for being here, guys.
Sure.
Great conversation today. And if you all would like to know what we're up to over here at Brent Smith Lifestyle, you can go to BrentSmithLifestyle.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you all later.